Parshas Korach, the eponymous Parshas Korach, deals with, of course, Korach's rebellion. So, rebellion, specific rebellion in general, has two components. There's power, there's the authority, who's in charge, who makes the rules. Korach didn't accept Moshe's authority, he wanted to do things his way. The other aspect is the actual issues that were being debated. Korach said, "Yikol Eid Kul Kedoshim." The theology, doctrine, what the underlying issues were. So in Chazal, in the Shkaf in general, we find both aspects of the rebellion. We find the machlokas. We speak about losia k'korach v'chadaso, the idea that Korach is the epitome of machlokas. Mishnah Berakhei Ava says kol machlokas. Jilu Shem Shemayim is Sofa L'Skayim, Machlokas Ein L'Shem Shemayim, Machlokas, which is not for the sake of heaven, which is for personal gain, or for one's own honor, or for dishonorable reasons, is not going to be L'Skayim. It's actually a fascinating passage in Yaakov Emden, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos on that Mishnah. Yaakov Emden has a passage that says that the Mishnah tells us that a Machlokas, which is not L'Shem Shemayim, it's not going to last. It's not going to, once the design, I guess, not the same for mine, is going to evaporate and disintegrate. So Rabbi Menachem asks, he says, Christianity, Islam, they've been around for 2,000 years, they're going pretty strong, he says. I don't know, something to a million Christians in the world. Various degrees of fervor and intensity. What happened to Kol Machlokas Shein L'Shem Shemayim? So he says, remarkable thing, he says, Christianity is L'Shem Shemayim. We believe they're wrong, he says, they're not right about what they believe, but they mean well. So they disagree, they think what they think, but it's a noble Machlokas. He goes so far as to say that Christians throughout the generations have offended the Jews. I don't know what he's talking about. They've certainly been responsible for, even if there's two, there's certainly been some, some Christians who have been upright and who have loved Jews and offended Jews, but the vast majority, both the lay and the clergy and the elite, certainly have not. I don't know what he means exactly. But in any event, Rabbi Yaakov Emden actually claims that Christianity and Islam are machlokas l'shem shemayim, which gives kind of an expanded definition of what machlokas l'shem shemayim means. We have contemporary divisions in the Jewish community. People often say that the other side is not l'shem shemayim. Just, not going to discuss any specific machlokas, but just bear in mind that even Christianity and Islam, Rabbi Yaakov Emden is willing to say we're l'shem shemayim, so it's not such a stretch to say that there are certain denominations of Judaism which we think are wrong. Still might be L'Shem Shemayim by Rabbi Yaakov Emden's definition. In any event, in this discussion, I want to focus on the meat of the machlokas, not just the authority and the politics, so to speak. I want to speak about the underlying issues that were at stake, and I want to discuss the notion of heresy, the notion of dogmas of Judaism, doctrines, and the notion of heresy. So, in Sanhedrin, the one place in Shas where heresy, where dogma and doctrine are discussed, is in Perichelek, the 11th parak of Sanhedrin. 10th parak going to some orders in the Masechta, but in the Sanhedrin, very famous Mishnah, the Mishnah says, all Israel has a Chelek Olhava, every member of Israel in good standing you're going to get eternal life, the world to come. Shenemar, v'ameh kulam tzadikim, olam yirshu aretz. Thy nation are all tzadikim, are all righteous. They're all going to be yirshu aretz, which the Chazal understands to mean the world to come. Then the Mishnah goes on and says, the exception that proves the rule. The exception that proves the rule, ve'elu she'elam ke'elbon haba. There are several categories of people. There are groups that have no portion in the world to come. What are these? So the Mishnah then gives three examples. Omer, Ainski, Esimaisim, and Atara. Someone who denies that the resuscitation of the dead is a biblical principle. There actually is discussion in the commentaries why it says the word Minatara. Why doesn't it just say someone who rejects the Esimaisim? What the word Minatara means?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because I don't think that's mentioned in the Torah.
So the Gemara actually tries to find inferences in the Torah. They're not straightforward. They're drushes of Chazal, but some people say that's also important. You have to accept that there are drushes. Not enough to accept that the principle is true. You have to believe that there are Ramazin, Hamstein on the Torah. I'm not going to get into that today.
Yeah, but there is somewhere in the prophets where somebody brings somebody back to life.
Yes, that is very true. Yeah. Both Eliyahu and Elisha have stories in Malachim where they brought children back. They brought children back to life. Yes,
okay,
that is true. There's also a story we say once Haftaras. Several of these are Haftaras. There's also the story of Yecheskel in the Valley of the Dry Bones. It says that God took Yecheskel to a valley full of bones, and he said, "Will these live?" And he said, "No, you know God. And, you know, it doesn't seem like that to me." So God said, "You speak to them," and spoke to them, and they rose up, and they walked away. So all these cases, actually, both the Valley of the Dry Bones, as well as the stories of Elisha and Eliyahu, there are actually opinions of medieval commentators that those were actually about Yecheskel. It was only a mashal, it was a vision of Nevuah, it didn't happen in real life. And the ones about Eliyahu and Elisha, there are some who learned that they were not actually completely dead, they were comatose or something. But in any event, that is a good point, that there are some accounts in Tanakh of apparently people described raising people from the dead. In any event, that is the first of the Mishnah's principles. You have to believe in Kesa Mesa Min HaTorah. The second one is Ein Torah Min HaShemayim, someone who believes that the Torah is not divine. And the third one is Apikaras. We use Epicurus colloquially to refer to all kinds of heretics, all kinds of people, but Mishnah has something specific in mind. Not clear what that means. A little bit later we'll discuss what the Rambam used by the word Apicurus, but some kind of heretic or schismatic. Mishnah goes on and gives possibly other examples of people who have no share in the world to come, but we'll stick with these three for now, or at least the two that we have clearly defined. Resuscitation of the dead, Eitzkei Zemesim Min HaTorah, and Torah Min HaShemayim, the belief in the divine origin of the Torah. And as everyone points out, in the Mishnah, in the Talmud, there's no real Medrash, there's no real systematic theology, there's no creed, there's no comprehensive systematic list. Mishnah mentions these two things as examples of heresy of someone who has no share in the world to come. And it's actually in the Palestinian Talmud, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, this is where we get to come. So on this Mishnah, in the beginning of that parak in Sanhedrin, Yerushalmi has it as parak 10, I believe. So Rav says, Amora Rav says, Korach apikurus ahayah. Korach, the villain of this week's parsha, was an apikurus. Why? So the next part of Yerushalmi is a well-known text. It appears in various midrashim. Ma'asa, what did Korach do besides reject the authority of Moshe? What specifically did he do? So it brings a couple of examples. He posed kind of provocative theological conundrums to Moshe Rabbeinu. He asked him, he made a talus that was all made out of talus, a blue talus. He brought it to Moshe and he said, I have a talus that's all talus. Should I put tzitzis on it? He told him yes. So he asked him another question. I have a house that's full of svarim. So mezuzah is one little scroll on the wall. I have a house with a library that's full, top to bottom, full of svarim. So what he'll really need, that little mezuzah? Amar lo chayim. Told him, yes, you have to do it. So it says, Amar lo beharis kigris. He asked him if I have a taras, a section of taras, which is small, size of a gris, small bean. He told him, tummy, that's the minimum size, that's tummy. Parcha bakula, spread for the whole body. Amar lo tar. Basically, he showed him three examples of kind of paradoxical halachas, of halachas that seem to be counterintuitive, that seem to not make sense, and Moshe had no choice but to answer them accurately.
Let's get the second example.
A house full of books.
So technically, according to what I've learned, is you don't need a mezuzah on that, because the standard I believe is somebody has to live in the place.
That's a good point. Yes, we ask in a shul of certain places that are not meant as residences. That is a good point. Yes, I think the answer here is he wasn't talking about a shul, it's about a private house, but someone who has an avid collector, avid bibliophile, with thousands of svarim in his house. My father has a few thousand. Other people I know have. You're right. If it would be not a residence, that would be a good point, yes. So basically, he presented to Moshe these three paradoxical halachas. He forced Moshe into saying things that would seem strange. Moshe Shah, Korach, sees the advantage. This is all like a plot. He sees the moment and he said, Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. See how ridiculous this is. Ein Torah min haShemayim. The Torah is not divine. Moshe just making it up as he goes along. Lo Moshe Navi. Moshe is not a prophet. Lo Aaron Kohen Gadol. Aaron is not the true high priest. And Rav summarized that by saying, Korach HaPikurisahayim. Korach was not Pikuris. He rejected Torah min haShemayim. He rejected the prophecy of Moshe. That's what the Talmud says, that Korach was not Pikuris.
Is there another interpretation, like he was just jealous?
Yeah, I think that's true. And then even according to Yerushalmi, we would have to psychoanalyze Korach to try to understand what did his theological issues that fueled his jealousy, which is the jealousy that caused him to look for a theological pretext.
Right.
I think those are good questions, and I'm sure in the various Midrashim commentaries, I'm sure we'll find all kinds of different ways to look at Korach, the various Musar writers, the various contemporary writers. You know, Korach is doubtless a complex subject, and I'm currently not trying to give a full, not going to attempt a full portrait of Korach. I'm just going to focus on this part of the Yerushalmi that emphasizes that whether it was the root of his problems, the outgrowth of his problems, at some point or another, Korach became an Epicurus, and he rejected these two or three dogmas of Judaism. And these, of course, are the first two. Not, I don't know about the Aaron Kohen Gadol part, but at least the first two points, Ein Torah min haShemayim, v'lo Moshe Navi, those are two of the Rambam's famous 13 animamim, 13 principles of faith. The history of the principles of faith, as we noted earlier, the Talmud doesn't really have any kind of systematic theology. The Gaonim, the period between the years, say, 600 and 1000, began to formulate systematic theology. The most famous this one is probably Sadia Gaon, Bruno Sadeus. He spent a lot of time on principles and systematic theology. But of course, the Rambam, Maimonides, is by far the most famous one. The Rambam's 13 principles appear in a number of different formulations. There are basically four different statements we have of the Rambam's principles. One of them is his commentary to the Mishnah on this topic in Sanhedrin, where the Mishnah talks about people who are heretics. Rambam has an extraordinarily long discussion of dogma and Judaism and principles of faith. Typically, the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah is quite short. It's a few lines to the Mishnah. Here he just has pages going through a lengthy explanation. He explains why he does it. More discussion of that, you have to attend Rabbi Zakeh Mishra on a future occasion where you'll be discussing this part of Rambam. Anyway, that is one. That's the most detailed and careful exposition of the Rambam's 13 principles. The second exposition appears in the Rambam's Yad HaZaka, his famous halachic work, in Hilchos Tshuva, where he talks about doing tshuva, not doing tshuva, what are the consequences if you do tshuva, what are the consequences if you don't do tshuva. So he discusses different levels of sin and villainy, different levels of egregiousness. So eventually he gets to Eilach Hamas Olam Haba, people who have no Chelach Olam Haba, and he lists different categories of Apikores and Min and Sectarian, different categories, different labels for the people. We're not going to get into exactly how he uses the word Apikores and Min and other words, but basically he lists the famous 13 principles. These are the two kind of official or scholarly explanations of the 13 principles. The two that are more popular, that are perhaps better well known, ironically neither were written by the Rambam himself. One of them is, of course, I keep using the term animam, one of them is a short list of animam, as we call them, printed in many siddurim, after chakras very often, a list of 13 things that begin, I believe that, animam, and I believe X, Y, Z, 1 to 13. That's probably more popular, printed in many siddurim, some people recite them after davening in the morning. And the fourth is actually the liturgical poem of Yigdal. Some people say it on Shabbos or Yontif. Some people say it in the morning, after davening, before davening. The Yigdal is a poem set in meter and poesy that basically lists the 13 principles and lists one after another, one line each, a short, pithy, poetic list of principles. As I noted, ironically, neither Yigdal nor Animamin is of known authorship. We don't know who wrote either of those. There are various theories as to who wrote them. Yigdal in particular has been attributed to various notable Jewish poets and thinkers. Some of them are almost definitely incorrect. Somebody actually attributes, I think, Yigdal to some of the lived before the Rambam, Shlomo Ibn Gaviro, a famous Spanish poet. But it's virtually unthinkable that he would have written Yigdal, since the 13 principles don't appear in any concrete form until the Rambam. In any event, nobody really knows who wrote Yigdal. There are several theories. Any Mammon, there is more mysterious. They start appearing in Siddurim. Nobody really knows who wrote any Mammon. And they have to be seen as a little bit less reliable, a little bit less authoritative than the lengthier and then the length of your explanations in the Rambam itself. In any event, these are the four more or less precise, more or less authoritative versions of the Rambam's 13 principles, which are by far the most popular and most authoritative. Those are these four: the commentary to the Mishnah, the Rambam's Mishnah Sara, the Yad HaChazaka Mishnah Sara, the Yigdal, and the Animam.
The Mishnah Torah. Did he write that work before the Shulchan Aruch?
He didn't write the Shulchan Aruch.
No.
Yes, it was written. The Rambam lived about 300 years before the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam lived in the 12th century. Shulchan Aruch lived in the 16th.
And was he one of the scholars? When they put together the Shulchan Aruch, did they include the opinions of the Rambam?
Yes, the Shulchan Aruch was written by Rabbi Yosef Karo in Spanish, and then later in Israel, Sephardic Jews. He was a great admirer of the Rambam, and he explained that he based the Shulchan Aruch primarily on three authorities. They were the Rif, Yitzhak Alfazi, the Moroccan rabbi from the 11th century or so, 10th, 11th century, Rambam from 12th century, from Spain and Egypt, and the German, later Spanish authorities from the 13th and 14th century, but even though he says he used that triumvirate of scholars, by far the most important influence on him was the Rambam. He actually wrote a commentary to the Rambam called the Kesef Mishnah, which we'll mention a little later. By far, the Rambam, his language, especially in some sections, I would say is 90% drawn from the Rambam. By far, the Rambam was the most important influence.
If you wanted to look up a matter in Jewish law,
he's going to go out with them to war.
Could a person look up the Yad HaZaka and see what the Rambam's opinion is on that?
Many people do. Even today, after all the subsequent layers of code and commentaries, there are many people who still find a special affinity for the Rambam. And many people do. Chabad Lubavitch has a special attraction to the Rambam. Even some people, I have a friend here who's I have a friend who finds a special love for the Rambam. So there are people who do. Most mainstream Jews wouldn't pass the straight to the Rambam because, as great as he wasn't the only commentator, and especially for Ashkenazim, the Rama wrote his notes to the Shulchan Aruch largely because he felt that the Shulchan Aruch himself, Rabbi Yosef Karo, being a Sephardi, he felt had overemphasized the Rambam and the Sephardic authorities and underemphasized Ashkenazim. So, especially for Ashkenazim, we pass it like the Rambam a little bit less than Sephardim do, but you cannot underestimate the importance of the Rambam for halacha was, particularly for the Sephardim. As a matter of fact, we'll touch on some points of the great Maimonidean controversies. Ramban, when he's trying to impress upon some of the Rambam's opponents how important he was, he quotes a tradition which has not been independently confirmed. He said the Rambam was very helpful to the Yemenites, to help them. He gave them moral support, he gave them spiritual and religious guidance.
Ramban
says it about the Rambam. The Rambam was a great towering influence of the Yemenite Jewry, he says. Until today, the Ramban says in Yemen, when they recite Kaddish, they say, "V'chayechon, v'yomechon," as we do, "V'chaye marona v'rabona Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon." So they said, in our life, in our day, and in the days of our master, Moses Maimon. And he's such an outsized influence on them that they injected him into Kaddish as someone who's worthy of mention as
attribution.
Yes. In any event, so these are the Rambam 13 principles of faith, and Rambam emphasizes that it is crucial for Jews to accept these, to believe these. A Jew who believes all these principles, he may not have to prove them, he might not be advanced enough to prove them philosophically, but at least if he accepts them, if he knows them, accepts them, then he is he's a Jew in good standing. Even if he sins, he's a sinner, but he still remains a Jew in good standing, a member of Israel. If he rejects these, if he refuses these, then he basically is written out of Klal Yisrael. Rambam writes, Yotzei min HaKlal, he's left the community, Kafar Be'ikar, he denied the fundamental doctrines of Judaism, he's called a Tzaduki, an Apikores, he's called someone who destroys the foundations of Judaism, and it's a mitzvah to hate him, etc. And he really draws a very fine line between those who accept these principles and those who do not. Now, a full discussion of what, of why these 13 principles, of what the organizing principle between them is, what the common denominators between them are, beyond the scope of our talk. First, I want to just mention that 2 points. First, it should be understood that not all Rishonim, either before or after the Rambam, not everyone accepted the specific list of 13. There were those who felt they should be condensed into smaller, tighter lists of 3 or 6, or there are different lists, notably by, I mentioned earlier, Osadia Gaon didn't have 13, he had different lists, he had different understandings of the principles. Around his followers in particular, some of them specifically, explicitly rejected his formulation. But Yosef Albo and his Sefer Ikrim, the entire Sefer devoted to the Ikarim, I think 3 is a better number.
Something just occurred to me. Why don't we say the Ten Commandments are the principles of our faith, rather than come up with these?
So, that's a good question. So, to some extent, that's really behind the objection of these other people who told around them these 13. Why are they so significant?
Why is it more than I am Hashem?
As the Ten Commandments, the problem really is, as some of the medieval scholars pointed out, many of the Ten Commandments are not really beliefs, they're actions, especially the last half. Don't kill, don't steal. The Rambam's principles focus mostly on doctrine. There is one or two that are veered toward action, but not praying to other entities. But on the whole, they're really doctrinal principles. Ten Commandments, you're right. The first one is a theological principle, which is actually one or more of the Rambam's principles. But the second one, idol worship, is also, but from the third on, they have more to do with conduct and less to do. But you're right. The basic point you're raising, where did the Rambam get this from? Who told him these 13? Was indeed an objection.
Take a case where a person completely accepts all these 13 principles, but they're a thief, they're a murderer.
So the Rambam mentions exactly your case. The Rambam says, if someone believes these 13 principles, so he says, Afilu asa kol mashiachol min haveris. He's done everything he can of sin and crime, nachmas hataiva, his lust, hatekbaris hateva, hagarua, the overwhelming power of his bad nature. God will punish him according to his sins, but he still gets chayav on avos. He's punishing Israel. He's classified as a sinner of Israel. We're not going to honor him ultimately at the dinner, but he's a sinner. But he's a Jewish sinner. He's still in Klal Yisrael. The Rambam felt that you're right. This is not an obvious thing. This is a kind of provocative and interesting point. But the Rambam believes that there's a difference between an egregious sinner and someone who rejects the foundations of faith. But beyond those who disagreed with the number of the Ikarim, there was also a movement who didn't like the idea of principles at all, who felt that all aspects of Judaism are equal and it makes no sense, it's just completely wrongheaded to single out some group and claim these are dogma, everything else is not. The Kabbalists in particular, for Kabbalistic reasons, which I'm not familiar with, didn't, Arizal, I believe, and others didn't like this idea of principles, and even some of the non-Kabbalistic thinkers expressed great unhappiness with principles. For example, the Radbaz, or David Ibn Zimra, who was an Egyptian rabbi at the same time as the Shulchan Aruch in the early to mid-16th century. Someone asked him, multiple choice, they asked him, whose list of the principles do you like best? Do you like Rambam? Do you like Rabbi Zafta Kreskes, a Spanish scholar? Or do you like Joseph Albo? I mentioned the student of Zafta Kreskes. 3 of the classic works on the principles. Which one do you prefer? Multiple choice, A, B, or C. He answered, none of the above. Ain dati maskemes. I don't agree with the whole project of making a car. I don't agree with the whole premise. I think the whole thing is wrongheaded. Chakula ekum and agura. Everything is in that Torah. And Chazal said, if you reject even one pasuk in the Torah, that's it. That's already unacceptable. How can we possibly pick and choose among the commandments of the Torah, among the beliefs of the Torah? It's all in the Torah. You have to believe in the entire Torah. I don't agree with the Dabar Brunel in his Sefer Rosh Hashanah. Also makes this point against the Rambam. He says that again, he doesn't really understand. How we can single out specific. Principles. He says they're all important. He says the Divine Torah, this is a translation by Professor Menachem Kellner of the Sefer Rosh Hashanah, an entire Sefer again on the commandments. Rabbi Brunel was a 15th century Spanish scholar, left Spain with expulsion in 1492. The Divine Torah, with all its belief, is completely true. All its commandments were divinely revealed. The validation and substantiation of all the beliefs and commandments, minor as well as major, is the same. The validation of one is like the validation of another. I therefore believe it is not proper to postulate principles for the Divine Torah, nor foundations in the matter of beliefs, for we are obliged to believe everything that is written in the Torah, not permitted to doubt even the smallest thing, etc. One who denies the belief narrative of the Torah, small or great, is sectarian, not Picarus. And he brings riots from Chazal, from that thing that Radbaz brought, that you have to believe in all the Torah. He then goes on and he tries to justify what the Rambam was doing by bringing Ikarim. He says these are particularly important beliefs to teach people, that for a Jew, it's very important that he understand these. If, you know, in school, you can't teach everything, you can't focus on everything. These are things that you should focus on and make sure every Jew, at whatever level of his education, should know at least these things. But in terms of the legal status, in terms of the actual technical requirement to believe, the status of a non-believer, who says there's nothing special about these 13, like the Radbaz, who was before the Radbaz. This was a school of thought that believed that in terms of the halakhic status of someone who doesn't believe, there's no real difference between rejecting these beliefs and rejecting anything else in the entire Torah.
Whose position is that?
This is Rabbi Yitzchak Abarbanel, Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, as he's referred to sometimes, the great rabbi and statesman in Spain in the 15th century, as well as the Radbaz, Rabbi David Ibn Zimra, the senior leading rabbi in Egypt in the early 16th century, and there were others too. These are two representative examples. So for the remainder of our talk, I want to discuss a controversy about one of the specific principles of the Rambam. This is interesting, in my view, fascinating, although you can judge for yourself, both for the theology involved, for the history involved, as well as for for the light of the shed on the basic question again of what is the significance of the Ikarim? What does it mean that these are Ikarim? This is something which doesn't really generate a lot of interest today. The great battles that were once waged about this are kind of in the past. But in its time, this is apparently quite a controversy, and that is the Rambam's third principle. The third principle is the belief that God has no body, that God is corporeal, he has no form, he has no place, he has no geographic, he doesn't occupy a specific point in space. God is completely incorporeal and tangible and not something that's part of the physical, natural world at all. Today this seems pretty self-evident. Most of us don't lose a lot of sleep wondering if that's true. This was not so obvious in the time of the Rambam, apparently. The Rambam developed this in several places in the Torah. In Yesodei HaTorah, the first section of the Rambam's Yad, where he lists, where he goes through and also systematically many of the philosophical, theological foundations of Judaism, he says, it is explicit in the Torah and the prophets that God has no body. He says, what does it mean when the Torah uses anthropomorphisms? The Torah describes God in physical, even human terms. Etzba Elokim, the finger of God. Yad Hashem, the hand of God. Einei Hashem, the eyes and ears. It's all Mashal, he says. It's all language that humans can relate to. It's all complete parables, allegories, absolutely not physical, and so on and so forth. The Rambam goes on and says that God also has none of the aspects of body. He has no emotions, he has no laughter, no joy, no sadness, no tears, no anger, no none of that. All those languages in Karosa, Karonaf, God's wrath, all that is also only Mashal. It describes the way God acts in certain places, certain to us, relates to us in different ways. It's all Mashal, he has no movements, he has no aspects that relate to entities in the physical world. All the language and the biblical text, as well as the corpus of literature, are all allegory and metaphor. And in Hilchos Teshuva, where he lists the 13 principles of faith, again, this is one of the principles, this is number three. Omer, the first two are those who reject the existence of God, the unity of God. Number three is someone who concedes the Yesham Ribon Abad, there is indeed one God, Avol Shu Gufu Balfuna, but who claims or asserts that he has a body, that he has some kind of image. Such a person is a sectarian, basically a heretic of some sort. That's what the Rambam writes in the Yad HaChazaka. In a letter, a couple of his letters, the Rambam deals with some people who apparently believe that God did have a body or some sort of body in his time. In one particularly notorious passage, there is a document that purports to be a kind of ethical will of the Rambam, a letter charged full of instructions for ethical and religious conduct to his son, Rabbi Avraham. Rambam had one famous son, Rabbi Avraham, usually known as Rabbi Avraham, the son of the Rambam, who was a noted Talmud and scholar in his own right. So there is a document that purports to be a will of the Rambam. So the Rambam uses remarkably pungent language. He tells him which books to learn, which scholars to esteem, to follow, and which ones not. So he tells him, stay far away from the books of the scholars of France. The scholars of France.
Stay away from France.
France. It's to stay away from their works. They only recognize their God, he says, when they eat the sar hashar, the meat of the ox, cooked and dipped in hummus, vinegar, b'shumin, and garlic, utibel and nikra b'lashan of salsa. That's a dip they call salsa. I'm sure this is related to the Latin American salsa. And he said to them, the vinegar of the vapors of the vinegar rise, and the steam of the garlic rises into their heads, and then they think they understand theology, they understand God, and they think he's close to them with their prayers. He calls them coarse and vulgar, and they think all they learn is the Talmud and the works of the Russian yeshiva. And he says also, and then he gets to anthropomorphism. He says they mention God all the time in a crude anthropomorphic way. He's far above their crude, vulgar conceptions of theirs. This letter is very controversial. Many have felt that this letter is a forgery. Both because the language he uses against these were the Balei Tosfos, these were the Tosafists, some of the greatest scholars of Talmud in the medieval period. And as Yitzchak Shelat, one of the leading contemporary scholars of Rambam, says, the Rambam never, first of all, the Rambam's language is always much more refined, much more poetic, much more graceful, and this is just coarse and heavy-handed, he said, and insulting and vicious, he said. Lashon Hara, exactly. It's just vulgar, he says. This was clearly, he says, written by some later hack who put his name on it. And there were others. Yaakov Emden, notably much earlier, several hundred years ago, said this letter is an arrant forgery. The contemporary scholars also lean toward assuming that this letter is a forgery. Not all, though. Gift of Korsky has a paper, and an expert in Rambam. He says that there are some scholars who believe this letter was real. Marshall has a discussion with Marshall back in the 16th century. He's not sure this letter is real. He kind of assumes it is, and he says he attacks the Rambam. He says this is way out of bounds. He says maybe the letter's not authentic. He kind of vacillates on it a little bit. But in any event, there were people who had crude anthropomorphic understandings of God. And the Rambam and his followers were very, very opposed to it. As a matter of fact, we have a very famous, very cryptic, very difficult to understand comment of the Rabbit, also a remarkably pungent and nearly as coarse as that last comment of the Rabbit. On the Rambam who wrote that someone who believes Hashem has a body is a heretic, the Rabbit said that there are a number of different variations of the text. As we all know, the standard one reads as follows. Lama Karo Lezemian, why did he call such a person a heretic? But there are Kama Gedol B'Tov Mimenu, Halko B'Zol Machshava. There are many people who are greater and better than him who did believe God had a body. Why do they believe that? The Bima Sharob and the Gros, they saw that in Sukkim, and even more, they saw it in Midrashim, the Shabbos and the Deus, they saw various Midrashim that indicate that. So he attacks the Rambam. Why do the Rambam call them heretics? There are people who are greater and better than him who believe that Hashem had a body. Now, there are many texts in this Rambam. First of all, that word Mimenu, the Rambam would call such people better than the Rambam, is hotly debated. Some texts in the Rambam don't have that word Mimenu. Some say the word is Me'amenu. There are many great people from our nation who are, just change one letter from Mem to an Ayin, or add an Ayin before between the two Mems. Some say Mimenu just means, Mimenu means from us. It means there are many great people from our nation, Mimenu, from our group, who believe it. Not that they're greater than the Rambam, not the Shalom. In any event, almost all commentators agree, the rabbi himself agrees that God has no body and rejects the idea that Hashem has a body. He's just saying that you shouldn't be so quick to call him Rabbi Karach. There are serious people, there are learned, scholarly, and well-meaning, well-intentioned Jews who believe that Hashem had a body because they were misled by the language of the Bible, by the language of the Bible. You shouldn't be so quick to condemn them and call them Rabbi Karach. There are other texts describing, but in any event, what is clear is that the rabbi rejected the idea. The rabbi rejected the idea that we should call somebody an apikara, a heretic, right? A man of Judaism for believing that God had a body. Now, to understand this rabbi, it has to be put into historical context.
Excuse me, historically, where was the Ra'abad? What country was he?
He was in Provence.
In Spain?
In southern France.
France, yeah.
Border between. Back then, Provence was a kind of separate country, separate region. It was kind of situated on the border of France and Spain, so culturally it was a kind of ferment, a mixture of more Christian, more traditional attitudes of Spain and France, and more Muslim, more philosophical attitudes that were very common among some of Spain. It was an interesting place, and it was full of some of all kinds of orientations. So, in order to understand the rabbi, we have to put it in his Rabbi Nachum Kasher, a great 20th century scholar, wrote a prodigious, very valuable essay on this topic, 30 pages of analysis of this issue. He points out that, as I mentioned earlier, there were several waves of Maimonidean controversy. Didn't really happen much while the rabbi was still alive. There were several waves that began after he died. The first one, I think, was a few decades after he died, in the time of his son, Rabbi Avram, and other defenders of his. Second wave was a few decades after that. Third wave, the rabbi lived in the 12th century, so these were happening mostly in the 13th century, and the third wave was in the time of the Rashba. Early 14th century, 1305, 1306. In each of these stages of the controversy, there were basically two groups arrayed in battle against each other. There were the more traditional-minded scholars, typically from France, the non-philosophical scholars who tried to build Judaism internally, didn't feel they had to turn to secular culture, secular philosophy, Muslim philosophy. Aristotelian Greek philosophy, they felt that Torah should be studied in its own terms, Torah was sacred, we shouldn't borrow from other cultures, we shouldn't reinterpret the Torah in light of foreign ideas. Then you have the Rambam and his followers. The Rambam, of course, was influenced very heavily by Aristotle. He quotes him heavily throughout his Maran Vukim. His thought in general was based on the cutting-edge science and philosophy of his day. His defenders believed that there was great wisdom in the non-Jewish society, which had to be explained and integrated, etc. And they developed their system of thought based on what was then the finest and best science and philosophy of the day. Science and philosophy were refined back then, and that was basically Greek or Italian philosophy refined through the Muslim followers in the early medieval period. This Machlokes, of course, echoes down through the generations until our present time, of course, we have, to some extent, that's really at the root of the differences between modern orthodoxy and the more traditional versions, whether your Judaism should be influenced by secular culture, secular science. Some of the battles against Rabbi Slifkin's works are rooted in these, this Machlokes, really. The Rambam, of course, has become pretty sacred, and nobody really challenges him directly anymore, although we kind of set aside many of his more radical ideas. Gaon famously said about the Rambam that his philosophical Arura led him astray. In many areas, the cursed philosophy of Greeks misled him. But in any event, throughout history, we have these bouts of Rambam, pro-philosophy, pro-science, pro-secular culture. And each time the exact ground rules, the exact battlefield is a little different, but ultimately the Machlokes is a similar one conceptually throughout the generations. Should Judaism be studied exclusively? Should we build only internally? Or should we turn to secular sources for inspiration, explanation, enlightenment about what Yahadis really is? There's actually a fascinating little outbreak of this occurred
in the 16th century between the Rama and the Marshal. They were actually cousins, distant cousins, or maybe not so distant, but Jewish relation was exactly. They were arguing about something really technical in halacha. They were arguing about something to do with the laws of trefa. They were arguing about a certain physiological condition in the body of a cow, some kind of growth or
tumor
or something, and discussing anatomically what this was. So the Rama, very, very technical, one of the most unexciting or kind of dry technical discussions you can imagine. The Rama quoted something from Aristotle, something physiological about what Aristotle wrote about everything, including anatomy and physiology. He quoted some completely innocuous passage from Aristotle to try to identify what condition the Rama was talking about. Marshall had a connection. Marshall wrote a letter to him saying, how can you do that, he says. He's saying the Torah is you're girding yourself with sackcloth and ashes, and you've betrayed it, and you've brought a rival into its home. Greek wisdom, chas v'shalom. The Rama was taken aback. He's like, I didn't do anything, he said. All I did is quote a harmless passage from Aristotle, and I don't even read it in the original. Everything I know is from the Rambam, he says. All week long I study Torah, he says. Only on Shabbos, he says, when people take vacations and go on little walks in the street, they take tefillin. That's when I open my Rambam and I study some Aristotle. And Rambam, he says, I'm spending most of my time on Shabbos and Poskim. But in any event, they argue about this too, whether a Jew should expose himself at all to secular culture. The Rambam says, look at all those who attack the Rambam and his followers. And the Rambam shot back, well, they had defenders too. The opponents were the last word on the subject. So, as I said, this is a machlokes that reverberates down through the ages. Even through today, yes, that's what I mentioned before. Right, even through today, we have echoes of the same machlokes. Now, back in the time of the Rambam, it's not entirely clear what they were actually arguing about, how much of it was a genuine disagreement and how much was based on suspicion and distrust. As a matter of fact, one of the most serious of all the charges leveled against the Rambam and his followers by the opponents were that by all their philosophical allegorization and interpretation, the opponents claim they were using it as an excuse to reject the authority of the Torah. Allegory really considered as part of his life, like the non-religious say today, it's all about being a good person, God doesn't really care if you put on tefillin or keep Shabbos. And that was something which the Rambam's followers vehemently denied. They said, chas v'shalom, none of us believe that. That's a calumny, that's a libel. We don't believe that. So that was something that was a question of mistrust. The opponents believed that was what they were really doing. They vigorously denied it. But one of the lesser known aspects of the controversy was belief in the incorporeality of God. The Rambam, as we've seen, made a big point of declaring that God has no body, no aspect of physical existence. And the Rambam said, don't call God a curse. There are many great people who believe that he did. Not only that, but we have a famous letter from the Ramban. The Ramban, during the first round of the Maimonides controversy, the Ramban tried to act as a peacemaker. He respected very greatly both sides. He respected the Rambam, but he also greatly respected the Rambam's opponents. He tried to temporize, settle, to bring the two sides to a greater understanding, to quiet all machlokes. I suppose a practical compromise as well to make each side understand each other a little bit better. He wrote a famous letter to the anti-Rambam people, to the hardliners in France. He tried to justify the Rambam and explain how great he was. He mentioned the thing about the Kaddish. He tried to explain what the Rambam did. In the course of the letter, one of the things he mentions is that he says, you anti-Rambam people who I have enormous respect for, but you're the father of the Torah, you're the one who are the great scholars of Torah, we all owe you so much debt, etc., etc. However, he says, I've heard that you have to critique the Rambam for insisting that God has no body. And we don't really have the primary sources here. We don't really know what they said. All we have is fragments of letters, which are not the best sources for theology. We do have one book of theirs called the Ksav Tumim. We do have one book of theirs that's been discovered called the Ksav Tumim, written by a man named Moshe Ibn Al-Kastoy. Moshe Taku is called sometimes. He does defend a somewhat remarkably physical description of God. It's very hard to understand what he means. He himself insisted he rejects the idea that God has a body, but yet he was opposed to the Rambam's hardline rejection of it. Anyway, the Ramban testifies that these great, great scholars and great Balei Tosfos in France attacked the Rambam for insisting that God had no body. The rabbi doesn't understand. He says, you know, you're such great people. You're such great Torah scholars. Don't you know the rabbi is right? He says, and he brings sources from the Chazal, and sources from the biblical text, and sources from the venerated early authorities of the Gaonic period, of the early medieval period. So, the rabbi is saying something else. Saying a chiddush, he says. The rabbi is saying something new. The rabbi is just another statement of a well-established tradition that God has no body. But in any event, the rabbi tells us clearly the rabbi's opponents, great as they were in Torah, somehow did seem to have believed that God had some aspect of a body. Again, it's difficult to know at today's rule what exactly they believed. But there was a belief apparently that was circulating, was somewhat current in medieval circles, that rejected the rabbi's notion that God had absolutely no body whatsoever. And the rabbi, even though we don't know exactly what he held, the rabbi is clearly sympathetic to these people. He may not agree with them. He might agree that they were wrong, and deeply wrong. He might have even held them as sinners. But he said it wasn't their fault. They were misled by biblical text. They were especially misled by Midrashim. And he's already said the rabbi was holding up a curse. These are great Torah scholars. This particular, you should not call such people up a curse. Now, we have to close. We're running out of time. We should just mention that, in general, the later authorities, the Gaonim and Achronim, have debated this machlokes Rambam and Rebbe. Should you take a hard-line view and insist that anybody who makes a fundamental mistake about faith is an apikoros, or should you say that someone is well-intentioned, well-meaning, and willing to learn, and they're making a good-faith effort to understand the truth, should be called an apikoros? There are many who follow the Rebbe. For example, the Sefer Ikkar itself follows the Rebbe. There are many great authorities who felt the rabbi is basically correct. And as long as somebody is earnest, serious, and not out to reject Judaism, even if he makes mistakes, we shouldn't call him happy chorus. On the other hand, there are those who vehemently reject the rabbi. Now, Barbanel, for example, says the rabbi is absolutely wrong, he says. According to this idea, even someone who denies all the principles, not just the third principle, let's say you deny Torah and Hashemayah, there are people today who still consider themselves Orthodox. Some people in the open Orthodoxy movement who have rejected the classic understanding of the divine authorship of the Torah. So, going to the rabbi, they mean well, they're trying. They believe what they believe. Even Christians, he says. Christians, they're also looking for the truth. Like we said, from Yaakov Emden, they mean well. But point to an apikoros and according to the rabbi, but they mean well. That can't be the rabbi says.
What is an apikoros?
Apikoros is a difficult word to translate, but it's usually used to mean heretics. Among the later commentators, and even the later, it's usually used to mean heretics. They say
that this dispute has a problem. It's either they're arguing in terms of it's either yes or it's either no. There's no middle ground, and maybe the one from Provence is the one saying, okay, so they're trying, so that's like the middle ground.
Right, so there are those who say that. They say for Hector and Balbo that it's wrong, that you'd be a sinner, but you shouldn't condemn them as a heretic.
Well, I agree with that.
But on the other hand, there are some views, notably of Chaim Soloveitchik, that has a famous pithy statement in Yiddish, attributed to him by several of his followers, who said, Apikoros b'shogeg is nebuch an apikoros. In Yiddish, English, I mean, someone who's unfortunately heretic. It's unfortunate, but he's still a heretic.
You know, there's a lot of
black and white, and if you don't believe it, you're an apikoros.
Look at today's Jewish world. There's a lot of people who just don't even think about these ideas. It's not that they're denying it. They don't even know about it.
And you're exactly right. And there are those, according to some of Rav Chaim's followers, they follow very strongly the rabbi and say, it's too bad, we feel very bad for them, but they still have the halakhic status. Again, we're not God's account. God decides what's going to happen on Haba. He'll take into account, is it their fault or not, and make justifications. But from a halakhic formal perspective, we have to categorize them as heretics.
Excuse me, okay, that's according to the Rambam?
The Rambam according to some interpretation.
So I've heard that the way we look at people today is that they're a Tinoch Shel Nishba. That's their halakhic status.
Yes,
it's not this.
That is a very good point, and the mainstream halakhic interpretation, the mainstream halakhic interpretation is someone is not orthodox, doesn't accept the tenets of orthodoxy, doesn't keep the mitzvahs. Many people, most people would consider them tinuk shel nishmas. And the Rambam, and not only that, the Rambam himself, in some places in his codes, is one of the main founders of that category. The Rambam himself talks about sectarians in his time, Karaites and others who clearly rejected some of the 13 principles, apparently did, and he insists on this. He says anyone who grew up like that, was raised like that, didn't have the opportunity to experience true, authentic Judaism, is not called an apikaris, and that is indeed a serious problem. I didn't have time to research that to the full extent. That is indeed a very serious objection raised to Rav Chaim's understanding of the Rambam. He himself allows for the category, and you're right, as a practical matter, that is the dominant view, I believe, of poskim, that we generally, at least some people, people argue about how much exposure do you have to orthodoxy before you lose your dispensation, but certainly someone who was raised and had no real exposure of his whole schooling and family life is all non-orthodox, certainly many, probably most poskim would say that they do not have the status of Rabbi Karis. Had to reconcile that with the Chaim's understanding, and the Rambam is, again, we're out of time, I don't want to keep everyone, but that is an excellent point, yes.